Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do your kids need to know in order to succeed in school? And do those skills really relate to the ones required for them to succeed in a career and in life? To parents wondering why the two lists might be so far apart, my guest today would add one other question. Why are other countries succeeding where America is failing? Tony Wagner is co-director of the Change Leadership Group at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. His latest book is called The Global Achievement Gap: Why Even Our Best Schools Don't Teach the New Survival Skills Our Children Need and What We Can Do About It. Tony, welcome to Think.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Chris.
What does it mean to be an educated American in the 21st century?
Well, Chris, you know, it's a very different answer in some respects than what we might have expected 25 or 50 years ago. But in other respects, it's not changed at all. But what has really changed is the world of work. I set out to interview executives and consultants to large companies in the last couple of years, trying to understand, in this new global knowledge economy, what skills will young people need to get and keep a good job? You know, this is an era in which almost any job that can be turned into a routine is either going to be offshored or outsourced. So what are the skills our young people are going to need today? And in these interviews, a list of 7 survival skills emerged, which were really quite surprising.
Yeah, we'll talk about that list in a minute. You write, for example, that teaching about the history of the Electoral College, which is something that everybody does, and you know, we consider that part of a standard education, it is great, but it doesn't necessarily prepare students to be thoughtful voters.
Exactly, Chris. What I see over and over again in classrooms is that we are teaching to multiple choice tests, and that students are not learning to think for themselves. They're not learning to reason, to analyze, to hypothesize, or even to do an effective internet search. So that while they may leave school with having memorized, but more often having memorized and forgotten facts like the Electoral College, what they can't do is read the newspaper intelligently and think for themselves and weigh the issues in a careful way.
So at the top of this list, you have critical thinking and problem solving. People understand that one. Another one that really interests me is agility and adaptability, because I think a lot of people imagine today's young people as being all about change and adapting to things, but then the culture of school is not that way at all.
Well, in both cases, that's the case. We're not, and as I suggested, we're not teaching critical thinking or problem solving. We're not teaching students how to ask the right questions, which executives told me is really what's behind being able to think critically or solve problems. We're focused on answers, not questions. And in terms of agility and adaptability, school requires sort of adherence to a routine day after day, year after year, 12, 16, 20 years, whereas in the workplace, even if you have the same job title, your responsibilities could be completely different a year from now. The structure and pace of change is so rapid in the workplace, unlike schools, that you have to be agile and adaptable to really thrive.
So I can hear someone shouting at the radio, okay, try adding agility and adaptability to the curriculum, and how do you make sure that that's on the state test of these sorts of things? Can you talk about how we teach skills like that while still making sure that everybody reads and writes and can do math and the things that we consider to be at the basic level?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me be clear. I believe in accountability and I believe in testing. And one of the things I came away understanding from this book project is that other countries are doing a much better job assessing and therefore teaching the skills that matter most. For example, there's something called the Program for International Student Assessment, or PISA, sponsored by the Organization for Economic and Cooperative Development. 40 countries took their problem-solving test, 15-year-old, represented samples of 15-year-old kids took this test. How do you suppose we did? We scored 28th out of 40 countries, behind all of the other European countries, and on a par with many sort of barely, first-world countries. So the challenge is to, first of all, find better national tests. And we don't have to test every kid. We can test sample populations of kids, which will enable us to afford these tests. But then to also realize not all skills, like, for example, agility and adaptability, can be tested in a paper and pencil way. The best test of agility and adaptability, in my experience, is for students to do projects, for students to have portfolios where they show their work over time. And I, in the last chapter of the book, profile 3 schools that require all students to do an extensive work-based internship, as well as complete an extended academic project for credit. Those are the kinds of things that help us assess whether or not a student has a range of these skills.
Yeah, internships at younger ages are so interesting because so many people will tell you college was great, but I didn't really learn anything until I got my first job. And I guess we could start that a little bit earlier.
Well, even more so, a lot of kids tell me I left college having absolutely no idea what I wanted to do and no sense of what the real world was going to require of me. So internships really, at the high school level, give you many advantages. It gives you a chance to explore different career possibilities, in some cases to find out that this is not a career you want to do. It gives you a chance to get to know other adults and to form kind of mentor-mentee or coaching relationships with adults outside of school, which is so important to so many young people today. You know, as an aside, I did a whole chapter on in what ways this generation is differently motivated and how important it is to have very different kinds of adult relationships. It came out loud and clear in the conversations.
Yeah, those motivations are really interesting. And, you know, when I was a kid, there was the idea of you wanted approval from the adults in your life, or at least you feared their disapproval. Many of us accepted the ways that our parents thought about the importance of hard work and the importance of sort of commercial success. Why hasn't that all filtered down to kids today?
Well, you know, that's the one thing that I found that educators, many educators and business folks agreed on, about the only thing they agreed on, was their common concern for this generation's, quote, lack of work ethic. Now, as a recovering high school English teacher myself, I was really interested in this question. Is this generation unmotivated or differently motivated? So I spent a great deal of time interviewing young people, and as well as reading the kind of literature about how this generation is growing up, very, very different than previous generations. This generation grows up tethered to the internet. For them, a bad day is a slow internet connection. And what that means is that on the one hand, they're kind of habituated to instant gratification, as well as to kind of multitasking in a kind of multimedia world. But on the other hand, they're really used to collaborating and creating, because those are the things that they use the internet for. They use it to collaborate with peers, you know, across town or across the globe, and they use it to constantly be creating new web content for themselves. So it's a very differently motivated generation. It's also a generation that cares less about money, but is, on the other hand, very impatient to make a difference. They want challenging, intrinsically interesting work, and they're going to demand it from their schools or turn off. And they're going to demand it at the workplace as well.
So as you were discussing, there are these three factors that play into things that have changed. There's a lot of media out there. We're in a knowledge economy. And there's a glut of information. And that comes back to what you're saying about the internet. What's very interesting is that we all know that our kids know how to use the internet and how to get to things. But we don't necessarily ask that question as to whether or not they have the maturity to really analyze what it is they find.
And skills, I would add, mm-hmm. Chris. You know, it's one thing to be able to Google. And these kids actually Google things for fun. They're just information hounds. They really are fascinated with the kinds of links that you can go to and explore on the internet. But I find many of them don't know how to distinguish truly important information from trivial information. So they don't know how to discern what's useful, what's more versus less useful, for example, because they've not been taught. They've not been coached. I think thinking is a skill that most of us learn through coaching. Now, many of us have been coached by our parents. Many of us learn to think around the dinner table by the kinds of questions our parents ask. But we cannot assume that kids are graduating from high school today having learned how to think. There are wonderful teachers out there who do it, but by and large, they are the outliers. They are what I call the random acts of excellence in our education system, because too many teachers say, I don't have time to do that. I've got to teach to the test.
You know, teachers, as we know, many of them are very passionate about helping their students, but you've also observed, by and large, they are resistant to change. Can you talk about some of the reasons for that?
Well, historically, I think education has tended to attract people who want and need a certain kind of security, who are risk-averse, for better or for worse.
Just by temperament.
Exactly right. They love school. They loved it so much they didn't want to leave. and school, as we know, is a very different world than other worlds of work. That's one problem. The other problem is that teachers work alone all day, every day. They are arguably the most isolated profession in American work life. So part of their immunity or resistance to change is temperament. Part is the nature of their working conditions, where they're working in isolation. And I think Not too many of us love and crave change. We come to understand the need to change or to improve continuously, in part, through kind of constant interaction with our peers, through learning new things, and embracing new challenges, things that many educators don't have the luxury of in their workplace today.
So in other words, they don't have contact with adults during the day. They're dealing strictly with the kids.
Exactly.
But a lot of schools do have these programs where they have, you know, special sessions once or twice a year. Is that just not enough? And is that too artificial to foster that sort of really creative interaction between professionals?
Well, they call this professional development. But let me ask you a question. If you were to sort of, you've been working alone all day, every day for, you know, 188 days, and then suddenly for 2 days a year, you get plunked in front of a room to hear some expert talk at you. On some new topic, and it's usually a different topic every single time. Now, I don't know how anybody calls that professional development. What, in fact, most of us need to get better in education is coaching. You know, I believe that teaching is both a performing art and a sport. You know, it's one that I enjoyed a great deal. And so how do people in the performing arts or in sports get better at something? They get coached, and they get videotaped. They're videotaped. Their performances are constantly analyzed and discussed as a group or as a team. And then they have a coach who helps them improve against a standard. These are things most educators find completely alien. It's not a part of their experience, not a part of how they were trained, nor is it a part of how they work every day.
And the other thing that doesn't seem to be communicated to a lot of teachers is why they're being expected to do things in a new way. You found teachers over and over that had sort of adapted to the new curriculum or whatever the new method was, but no one really made it clear why this was better than the way they'd been doing it before.
That's exactly right, Chris. Because educators as a profession are so isolated from other parts of our society, they really don't know that how the world of work has changed. Many educators, for example, still believe that preparation for the world of work and preparation for citizenship are in contradiction, because the world of work requires you to be an automaton, to be a good little obedient worker bee. That's a picture that's 50 years old. I just was reading some blogs about my book written by educators, and one educator said, you know, one of the greatest surprises in reading this book is to understand how radically different the world of work is and how the skills you need for work are the same skills you need for active and informed citizenship. He did not know that.
So how do you engage everybody to look at things in a really different way when they might be surrounded? You know, for the teacher who does want to change things, if that teacher is surrounded by other individuals that don't see things that way, what do you recommend?
Well, for individual teachers, it's a challenge. You know, the old saying is, don't ask for permission, only for forgiveness. And the best teachers, frankly, do that. They recognize that the state test, for example, your tax test, which I analyze, by the way, in the book as an example of one state test, these tests don't test the skills that kids are going to need to succeed for college, for careers, or for citizenship. And so the very best teachers use academic content and teach kids how to think in the context of their academic discipline. Oh, and by the way, not surprisingly at all, the kids do just fine on the state tests, because you don't have to memorize a bunch of stuff to do well on these tests. You really have to be able to discern. You read four possible answers to a question. You can usually, if you really understand what's being asked, can easily eliminate two, if not three, of the answers, and so you're home free. So teachers that sort of break the mold and teach kids to think and to communicate clearly and to collaborate well not only do fine on the state test, but most importantly, their kids are far, far better prepared for college. Did you know that one out of every two students who starts college today drops out? So, and they're not ready. They're not prepared.
We'll talk more about how to get students ready for college and the world of work in just a moment. Tony Wagner is my guest. He's co-director of the Change Leadership Group at the Graduate School of Education at Harvard. His new book is called The Global Achievement Gap: Why Even Our Best Schools Don't Teach the New Survival Skills Our Children Need and What We Can Do About It. You can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tony Wagner. His new book is called The Global Achievement Gap, Why Even Our Best Schools Don't Teach the New Survival Skills Our Children Need and What We Can Do About It. I want to talk for just a minute about the tax. You looked at the 10th grade test, and you have a sample of it in the book, and point out that the fact that Texas rates between a C minus and a D plus when it comes to academic rigor and the quality of state standards. But then you went and looked at the test for Massachusetts, which rates an A, and you didn't really find that it was arguably much better.
No, and by the way, these were not my ratings. These were ratings done by the Fordham Institute, which is an educational think tank that is really pretty conservative. So they were using their definitions of academic rigor. And quite frankly, I didn't see a lot of rigor in either case, in the sense that these tests really don't require any thinking, any reasoning, any analysis, any hypothesizing. And to the extent that both tests require some writing, which they do, what kids are asked to produce is a sort of five-paragraph essay that's kind of written by formula, and it bears no relationship to the kind of writing kids are going to have to do in the workplace and in colleges today.
Yeah, and what's scary about this whole system is that parents look at their kids' tax scores and they look at their kids' report cards, and they might be very pleased with what they see and still have a child who's not getting the education that they need.
Well, that's my biggest fear. As you've said, I, after analyzing the seven survival skills in the first chapter, spend a lot of time describing classrooms that I've seen in some of our very best suburban public schools around the country, asking the question, are good schools, in fact, good enough? Are they teaching the seven survival skills? And what I came to understand is that in many cases we are making what is called adequate yearly progress under the No Child Left Behind law, but failing our children. Our kids are passing the test, many of them, although growing numbers are not, but many they're passing the test, but in many cases, kids are not graduating high school. Our graduation rate from high school in this country is about 67%. A third of our kids are not leaving high school. And of the kids who do leave high school, more than half do not have the skills they need for the workplace or for college or to be an active and informed citizen. So passing these tests, in a sense, means nothing because we're failing our kids.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's speak to Beverly in Crowley. Hi, Beverly.
Hi. I would like to make a quick comment, and I guess it's a question, too. As a mom and an employer, I wonder if it might not be a good idea to separate out, you know, at like they do in Europe, as I understand, kids that are not really going to be college-bound from those who are, and make a track available for vocational school and then another track for college. And maybe that way the curriculum for the smarter kids wouldn't be dumbed down, and the curriculum for the not as well-equipped could be changed.
Well, Beverly,
I'll hang up and listen.
Thanks for calling.
Oh, okay, great. Good comment, Beverly. Thank you for that. We should be careful not to assume that the skills you need to be a good plumber or a good electrician or a good automobile mechanic are any different from the skills you need to succeed in college. They're not. They are the same skills. You know, incidentally, you know, a good plumber, electrician, automobile mechanic can earn six figures. But he or she is going to have to know how to use technology, have to work in a team, have to be continuously learning, use the Internet to acquire and analyze information. Whatever the job, the skills in the 21st century have converged with the skills you need for college. Now, I do agree with you, Beverly, that some kids may, in fact, benefit from or even prefer more sort of specific academic content that is college preparatory. But there again, you know, I went into lots of advanced placement classes where there was not any thinking going on. Kids were memorizing stuff for this test. So it's an illusion to think that a, quote, advanced placement course or a college-bound course is teaching the skills that are needed, in the same way that it's an illusion to think that just because you may not be going to college right away, you don't need to know how to think. Neither are true. And interestingly, I find lots and lots of kids who are in advanced placement courses really want a chance to work with their hands. And they would love to have a chance to take an automobile mechanics course also. And similarly, lots of kids who've been pigeonholed into these so-called vocational education courses really want and need to go to a trade school or even to a two-year college, and they'll graduate without the skills they need to succeed.
You have college professors telling you frequently that students are not ready to enter their classes fresh out of high school. A fifth of high school graduates need remedial courses at the university level. Does that imply, though, that a college education does instill students with the seven survival skills?
You know, at least there is an agreement that that's what college is supposed to be about, Chris. A friend of mine, a former college president, Richard Hirsch, spent a lot of time doing some research trying to understand what is the value added that college should produce for kids. In other words, you spend 4 years in this college or university, you spend a lot of money, what should you be better at or what should you know? Total disagreement about what content you should know as a college graduate, you know, within a department, across a university, or in many different universities. But there was complete agreement, he found out, that college should produce students who are able to do analytic reasoning, critical thinking, problem solving, and be effective communicators, those four skills. And so he developed this test of those four skills, which a few high schools are now using to assess college and work readiness. And it's an example of the kind of testing that I think we should be doing instead of this mindless multiple-choice testing we're doing now.
You mentioned communicating, and earlier we talked a little bit about the writing exercises required for tests to pass out of high school, not really relating to what you need to write in the real world. What kind of oral language skills are we denying kids in their standard high school education in this
country?
Well,
again, it's a great question. I go into most classes, and I'm in schools all over this country on a monthly, if not a weekly basis, so I'm in classrooms a lot. And to the extent that I hear kids talking, they're mumbling answers to teacher factual recall questions, and you frequently, if you're sitting in the back of the room, you can't even hear the kid's response. They mumble. They mutter. I can't remember the last time I saw kids have to give a speech. If they do some kind of oral presentation, it's usually very casual, very sloppy. That's in contrast to the three schools that I highlight in the last chapter of the book, where every single student has to not only do a final project that is, but they have to present it both orally and in writing. And when they present it orally, they present it to a panel of adults who are assessing their work. So in a sense, it's like almost like a dissertation defense at the graduate level. They have to prepare, they have to practice, and they have to really know how to be effective orally as well as in writing.
So if most schools don't require that, is that an outgrowth of the era where we didn't want to do anything that might sort of hurt the feelings or the self-esteem of the kids who weren't as good at it as other people? You know, there's always that one story of someone who was just paralyzed with fear at the idea of having to give a speech, and so a lot of times it was eliminated from curricula.
Well, certainly sort of wanting to make kids feel good has been, I think, a problem in some classrooms. Particularly in classrooms for disadvantaged young people. But I think more recently, the most serious problem is teachers feel they don't have the time to do this. You know, I was talking to Jonathan King, a microbiologist, a molecular biologist at MIT, and he's trained some of the leading biotech innovators in the world at MIT. And he says he also teaches an introductory course. And he has these kids, he says, who come into his lab having taken all of the advanced placement courses, but when he puts them in front of a microscope, they ask him, what should I be looking for? He says, just observe. They say, how do I do that? What's the answer? And he blames it on this kind of answer-driven, test-driven curriculum where kids have not actually done science. He tells us a really sad story, Chris. He had his two sons in public school here, and they had the same teacher in the same school, 2 years behind one another, in other words. And the older son went out into the pond and collected samples and brought them back and looked at them under the microscope. And it was just fascinating to him. And Jonathan said, you know, this son is learning how to do science. The second son had the same teacher, but a totally different experience. No trips to the pond, no time spent looking under a microscope. Why? Because the new state test had come, and they didn't have time.
Tony Wagner is my guest. He is co-director of the Change Leadership Group at the Graduate School of Education at Harvard. His new book is called The Global Achievement Gap. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Pete in Arlington. Hey, Pete.
Hi, Chris. Thank you for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm very much found interesting your guest comments on how do you make this link between the collaborative use of the Internet and the work environment, which I have seen firsthand, and the use of the Internet in education, and that a lot of people are wringing their hands feeling that the use of the Internet in education is not necessarily a good thing. Just a historical perspective for you to comment on. I'm sure that when Gutenberg invented the printing press and books started to be printed, that a lot of people thought that was a bad thing, that people would no longer communicate verbally and learn in groups. They could now go off in a corner if they could get light and learn by themselves. And yet you look at how much knowledge was advanced with the printing press. So it just seems to me there's an analogy there between the printing press and the Internet. And I just would like to know your comment. Thanks for taking the call, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Pete.
Well, that's a helpful reminder of history, Pete. Absolutely. Of course, everybody worries this generation is spending too much time on the Internet and they're spending too much time playing video games. But let me tell another little interesting anecdote that sheds the additional light on this. I watched this interaction between a father who was 40-something and his 20-something son. And this father was, struggling with the website at his work environment. And he said it just didn't seem right, but he didn't know what was wrong. He called his son over to look at the screen, and in 2 minutes, his son gave him a very clear, crisp, thoughtful critique of the website. So the son, in other words, had been educated in a different way and was able to take apart a website and tell his dad what was the matter with it, something his dad could not do. They had been differently educated. One was not better educated than the other. Now, there are skills that young man is going to need. I mean, he's going to have to read and write. There's no question about that. And I, by the way, want him to know academic content. I want him to know that the Civil War happened before World War I, for example. We're not talking about not using academic content here. But let's be clear. You know, if this young man wants to know who General Sherman was or when the Battle of Gettysburg took place, he can Google it. But what he cannot do is Google the causes of the Civil War, because to do that requires a conceptual understanding of what was taking place both socially and economically at that time. Nor can he Google ways in which the Civil War is still being fought today. Those are kinds of ideas that we really need young people to wrestle with, sometimes using the Internet, sometimes using good old-fashioned Socratic dialogues, which are, what, 2,500 years old?
My guest is Tony Wagner. His new book is called The Global Achievement Gap. We have an email here from Jim who writes, when talking about testing and assessments for students, does the diversity of our society affect how the tests are created or the students are tested? Perhaps in a country where people are more homogenous, like Sweden or some other European countries, it is easier.
Again, a really important question. I don't know if your audience knows this, Chris, but a special commission of the admissions deans of major universities just released a report about 3 weeks ago, and it was headed by the Dean of Admissions at Harvard. And the report said, we need to stop using SATs and ACTs as an admissions criteria for college for several reasons, but one of which is that they are very culturally biased tests and that too many people can also spend money on test prep and do somewhat better on them, which is another kind of bias, an economic bias. So I think there's no question that we have tests that are biased culturally. But it is also possible to make tests of the kinds of thinking skills that are important which don't have that bias, which you can use different kinds of content. And by the way, in many of these European countries, they're not as homogenous as you might think from television. Many of them have increasing percentages of immigrants, and they're dealing with some of the same kinds of challenges we have in our education.
When you go into a classroom, Tony, to observe, what, and I know it, sometimes you have a different mission when you're there, but what are you looking for in order to evaluate how effective the teaching is and the instruction is and how much it's sinking in with the students?
Well, that's a great question, Chris, and it's actually one that, might be helpful to parents. Parents want to know how good their school is. Rather than looking at the test scores, I encourage them to go spend time visiting in the schools and actually observing classes. But the question is, what should they be observing for? What I listen for, first and foremost, are who is asking what kinds of questions. Is it almost all teacher-driven questions? Are the questions almost entirely factual recall questions? Is the teacher asking any questions that require reasoning analysis or even comparison and contrast? Is the teacher challenging what a student says when a student makes a statement? What's your evidence for that? How do you know that? What do you think about this? Have you considered that? Those are the kinds of questions I'm listening for. Secondly, I'm looking for the quality of engagement. You know, the sad thing I see in most classrooms is that kids are compliant. I don't see misbehavior. It's just extremely rare to see kids acting out. But what I see are kids who are only 10% there. You know, their heads are on their desks or they're nodding in the background. They're only partially attentive at best. So, you know, a really engaged class where good questions are being asked, when there's a lively discussion, kids are intellectually alert and responsive. So those are the things I look for in a classroom. And then finally, I want to see evidence in their written work that these aren't just great discussions, but kids have skills. They've learned something. So I ask to randomly see a sample of student writing just to see what they're doing.
What's different about the countries where this is working? Are the kids in those classrooms sort of, they have their heads straight up? And why is it so much better?
Learning in the most successful countries is much more inquiry than memorization. Countries that, like Denmark or Finland, have realized, and this starts 15 or 20 years ago, they began to understand that in order for them to have a niche in this global knowledge economy, they're going to have to produce young people who can be innovators. And I believe, by the way, that's absolutely what we must do. So they don't test the way we do. They have open-ended, constructed tests, and teaching to those tests requires kids to think.
Tony Wagner is here. His new book is called The Global Achievement Gap, Why Even Our Best Schools Don't Teach the New Survival Skills Our Children Need and What We Can Do About It. We'll be back to our discussion in a moment. If you'd like to send us an email, the address is think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults. Short courses in the arts, writing, and history start weekly, a part of SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Details online at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Tony Wagner, who is director of the Change Leadership Group at the Graduate School of Education at Harvard. His new book is called The Global Achievement Gap. If you want to join us, send email to think@kera.org. Let's go now to Keith in Dallas. Hi, Keith.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great, thank you.
I wanted to ask Tony a question. I've noticed I spent about 35 years in the specialty credit industry, and I have two different graduate degrees. And when I retired, I started teaching at a junior college and then later started teaching at a major university, both graduate and undergraduate classes in accounting. And I've noticed a bright line difference over the last 6 years in the difference in reading comprehension skills of students that graduated from high school 12 to 15 years ago and students that have graduated recently. Just wondered if you had noticed that in any of the work you had done.
I have noticed that, and clearly kids are reading less today. But again, I worry as much about how much they read as what they're asked to do with what they read. And what so concerns me is this test prep curriculum I see in schools where kids are taking 9-10 practice tests in a year, and the practice tests require very low-level reading skills. And what's missing is classroom-based discussion of what you've read. You know, reading in part is a social activity. That's why book groups are so popular among adults. And what I find among kids is to stimulate their interest in reading as well as to teach them to think more critically about what they're reading requires classroom discussion and teachers acting as coaches, once again, saying, where did you see that in the text? What's your evidence for that? And that's just not going on in classrooms today.
Yeah, you talk about the idea that when they read something, ordinarily in the past, they might have been asked to apply some bit of literature to their own lives or to try and find an example in the real world that would correspond to what they've read. And that doesn't happen anymore.
You know, teachers say, I don't have time. I've got to cover this for the test. When they feel their careers are at stake or their professional sense of themselves is at stake based on these test scores, they're not going to take chances. It's the rare teacher who will take the chance and say, well, I really know that if I have more classroom discussion, these kids will think better and they'll do better on the test.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Anne in Dallas. Hi, Anne.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am curious if Mr. Wagner has heard of St. John's College, which is a great books program based on discussion, and what he thinks of it. And I'm also curious what he thinks of the work of John Dewey, who was an educational philosopher in the early 1900s, who also promoted a more active form of education that seems to coincide with what he is talking about.
Well, Anne, as it happens, I'm quite familiar with both. As I mentioned earlier, I'm a recovering high school English teacher, and I love discussing great books. I don't know if the St. John's College curriculum has been modified to bring in contemporary books. I hope it has. But I think there's nothing wrong with discussing great books, one of my favorite things to do. And as for that fellow John Dewey, well, I certainly admired his work and have been influenced by it. But, you know, what's different about that thinking today, Dewey, as many of you may know, sort of advocated more hands-on learning, more task-based learning. And he did it sort of from the point of view of a liberal educator. What I'm talking about today are sets of skills that not just the elites of our society are going to have always, you know, needed to some degree or another, but it's virtually all of our graduates are going to need these new skills if they want something other than, you know, a minimum wage job. And that's the challenge today. It's not just teaching the college-bound kids or some kids how to think and write well. It's teaching all kids. And what's exciting to me is that, you know, in the last chapter, profiling three high schools that do it, two of them are predominantly minority schools, and 100% of the kids are graduating, and nearly all of them are going to college and succeeding there. So we can do this and do it with all kids. And I think many of the ideas that John Dewey first put forward are absolutely essential as a part of the solution to this problem.
One of the seven components of your list of achievement of survival skills is curiosity and imagination. How do you get kids curious to learn something in a climate where they're able to pick and choose among the kinds of information that they consume anywhere else?
Oh, it's an important question. I'd start with an anecdote. You know, it isn't just our public schools that have a problem here. I'm sitting in a meeting with a senior executive from one of the most elite private schools in the country, and he turns to the small group of us there, and he says, why is it the longer our kids are in this school, the less curious they become?
Wow.
And the answer is that these kids, again, even in these elite schools, are taking advanced placement courses. I interviewed a kid taken 10 advanced placement courses. He went to a public advanced placement sort of academy, a school of choice, like a magnet school, taken 10 AP courses, done fours and fives and all the tests, and he was now at MIT, and he said, I'm burned out. He said, I am completely burned out memorizing stuff for tests. I didn't learn anything, he said, in these all I did was learn how to take a test. So by contrast, when you ask kids, as I did as a teacher, what are you really interested in? What do you want to know about? Because I'm going to require you to do a research paper. I required all of my students to do a research paper, which they had to then present orally to the class. But I gave them total choice in what they could research. So I was teaching a diverse group of kids, and one kid picked James Joyce to do a research paper on, the author. Another kid wanted to research the difference between a carbureted engine versus a fuel-injected engine. Both of them had to write 20 pages. Both of them had to use primary sources and use all of the conventions of a good research paper. But the difference was, because they could choose the topics they were interested in, they had a much more of a vested interest in doing a good job. Oh, and by the way, we're stimulating their curiosity as well as their imagination.
I have an interesting email from Samer in Dallas who writes, it sounds like Finland's education system took two decades to evolve. What can people do now to ensure a quality education, for example, home exercises to increase critical thinking skills and think Socratically? What do you say to parents who have kids in the system right this minute?
Well, first of all, dinner at home is a great teaching opportunity, provided you're not lecturing your kids. I learned that the hard way from my three. Provided you're asking them thoughtful questions. Well, what do you think about this election? Well, who do you favor? Why? And I'm not saying ask the 20-year-olds. I'm saying ask your 12-year-old. You know, these kids are remarkably thoughtful. Or what are you learning on the Internet? Show me an interesting Internet site. So that the more we can engage in real conversation with them around questions that we have, where they're teaching us something or telling us something about what they think or what they've learned, the more we're stimulating these qualities that I think are so important. As far as schools are concerned, I think you ought to go to your PTA meetings, you ought to go to your school board meetings and say, what are we teaching? What do we believe are the most important things our high school graduates need to know and to be able to do? And how do we know we're teaching the right things? I'd suggest take them the list of the 7 survival skills and say, to what extent are we teaching these? And you know, lots of educators say, oh, yeah, we do that. But then you say, okay, show me the assessment. Because in this country, what gets tested is the only thing that gets taught. So they say they're teaching critical thinking or they're teaching problem solving or effective communication. Say, show me. Show me the assessment. Show me the quality of student work. You know, parents, and I spend the last chapter describing the ways in which parents and community members need to work together to really advocate for a 21st century education system.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Jody in Southlake. Hey, Jody.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great, thank you.
I have a question. My question involves how can parents work better with the school to get their kids the education that they need. I have a senior, as a way of background, I have a senior who's graduating this year. He's taken 7 AP tests and has scored 5s on all of them and perfect SAT scores. Now it's time to write college essays where that critical thinking and analysis comes in, and he's doing okay, but not great.
Right.
I have a freshman, and I see where the problem begins because he is enrolled in a pre-AP English class. The last 9 weeks of which he's done one writing assignment, and the comments that come back talk about margins and capitalization, but no real substance, no real analysis. And I actually feel like I'm almost having to fight with my school administrators. I've been in to see the principals and the teachers and everyone but the school board about how can we get the skills that you talk about in your book, how can we as parents work with the school to get that taught when they're actually following their curriculum, they're on track with the books, they're all, you know, they're taking the tests, the multiple choice, and scoring well. How do you convince them to change what they're doing?
Well, you've asked the right question, my friend. And I think it's hard for one parent. Believe me, I've been in that same position with my 3 children who are now out of school. So my first advice is find some parents who think the way you do. And then form a little working group. And do some reading together so that you're not going in sort of without some awareness. I mean, the advantage of a book like mine, and I don't mean you have to use my book, but it provides very solid documentation about how important writing is, for example. It's one of the survival skills. And in fact, it's the number one complaint of college teachers and employers alike is that kids don't know how to write. And what they're really saying is kids don't know how to reason, and they don't know how to write with voice. They don't know how to write persuasively. So when 3 or 4 of you can go together to the PTA meeting and then even to the school board meeting and say, you know, it's very clear this is what our kids need, and here are our experiences with our children as parents. What can you do about this? I can tell you, I was a writing teacher. Kids have to write every week. It's not enough to write 4 times in a school year or in a school quarter. That's just ridiculous. And that is, in fact, one of the first questions I ask in a school. How often are your kids writing? How long are the papers that they're writing? I want to see, for example, every school require every student to have a digital portfolio that follows them K-12 so that you know immediately how often they're writing, what the quality of their writing is, how is it improving from one year to the next. And in the latter part of the book where I profile these 3 schools, all 3, in fact, do that. All their students have digital portfolios. And writing is an absolute focus. Writing is arguably the single most important skill we must equip our kids with, because to write well means you have to think well, and you have to practice, and you need coaching. Writing is thinking made public. So you're absolutely right to worry about it. My only advice is don't worry alone, and don't go in sort of without being armed with some information.
You know, what's alarming about the seven things on this list of skills is that they are items that are addressed in special classes for the talented and gifted. But it seems as though we've decided as a society that those are the only kids who are not only who need this, but who are capable of taking these things on. And clearly we all need this.
Absolutely right, Chris. And that's one of the things that's changed fundamentally. You could argue 30 years ago that, you know, only the elites are going to need these skills. Folks are going to become the doctors and lawyers and the leaders in our society. And that's what's really profoundly different. And you're right to also worry that some people think, well, kids from certain backgrounds can't master these skills. It's a waste of time. Whereas there is so much evidence now in so many schools that kids can do a great deal more than we ever imagined and are succeeding at learning these skills. Kids, you know, in High Tech High in San Diego, for example, they have predominantly minority kids, many of whom whose parents did not even finish high school. And yet High Tech High graduates 100% of its kids, and they got more kids into Stanford University last year than any other non-legacy high school, meaning than any other high school that did not have parents or alums who had gone to Stanford. So it's doable. There are existence proofs, as I call them out there, meaning there's ample evidence, not just theoretically, not just in kind of liberal do-gooders' hearts, but in real classrooms with real kids.
So when we're trying to improve the schools and we're trying to know exactly what is happening with our children and what's going on, I guess the most important thing that parents can do is make sure that they're reading what their kids bring home, and then if the schools aren't going to provide it, challenge your kids yourself.
Well, I think it's a tremendous challenge as an individual parent, as I've said, but I agree with you. Read their papers. Really look at them and look and keep the papers. If the kid wants to throw it away, say, can we please keep these in a folder? Look for evidence of progress. And if it's not working, then I would look for some kind of summer enrichment opportunities where kids are getting experiences out in the real world, and you encourage them to kind of write about what they're seeing and learning, even if it's just an email home. Writing, you know, requires practice, constant practice to get better at.
And just briefly, the schools that you profile that are doing a great job, how much is it more expensive to provide this kind of education than it is to provide what most public school students are getting right now?
You know, the cost varies so much. We in Cambridge are spending $20,000 a kid for our public education.
A year? Wow.
A year. Out in some, you know, impoverished cities, they're spending half or less than half of that. They're spending $5,000 or $6,000 or $7,000. If you averaged out the total amount that was spent in wealthy versus poor communities, we've got plenty. The issue is not money. The issue is will.
Tony Wagner is co-director of the Change Leadership Group at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. His latest book is called The Global Achievement Gap, Why Even Our Best Schools Don't Teach the New Survival Skills Our Children Need and What We Can Do About It. Tony, great discussion. Thank you so much for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.